Council of Jewish Women Oral History 2. It's March 21st, 1995. Howard Braun and Shama Weiss are interviewing Dr. Leib Kessler. Please tell us your name.
Leib Kessler, 6516 Beacon Street.
Shama Weiss are the Today, we plan to discuss your career.
In medicine.
In medicine, too. It's like you had two careers.
We'll talk about my career, and some of this will overlap because it has a lot to do with Montefiore Hospital and some of the history I gave about Montefiore Hospital on the earlier faith. But in order for continuity, I will stick pretty much to this subject of how it was my career and how it affected by the institution in Pittsburgh. I went to Penn State where I received a degree as a Bachelor of Arts. I spent years there between 1940 and late 1943. It was during that time that World War II broke out. And as a pre-med, I was deferred by the completion of the college. The war was on, and I chose not to stand around and wait for my admission to the medical school, which was scheduled for October 1944. In other words, I had a full year between graduation from pre-med. So that I joined the Navy and then managed to arrange to get back, and I think we did cover that story. I got back to Pitt Medical School, and during those years in Pitt Medical School was living at the Ruskin Apartments, which was my mother's home. The years were essentially uneventful as far as medical school went. As I mentioned earlier, there was the usual quota system that prevailed even during the war years. Those people who were in medical school were almost all in uniform, either the Army or the Navy, filled the spaces available to educate people for their various services. Only thing unusual that happened during that period of time, as the point of view of continuing the medical education, was my exposure in my years of medical school to Jewish community affairs, which became somewhat of a distraction, rather a pressing distraction, had some effect on my medical career in that I didn't give it as a student 100% of my time. Some of that is reflected in my grades, which were the top of the class in my first 2 years, and then gradually declined somewhat because of my interest in other affairs. But nonetheless, I graduated successfully, and that was in 1948. I believe that was March of 1948, and then I left for Europe as a representative of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, which we discussed earlier, and then came back after 3 months to an internship at Montefiore Hospital in Pittsburgh. That was a rotating internship. During that year, I think I discussed the Montefiore Hospital in those days as to what was going on and what the general climate was. Upon completion of the internship, I was able to obtain a license for examination to practice medicine in Pennsylvania, and immediately did so, opening an office in Squirrel Hill, and an office simultaneously in the Hill District. it was my goal at that time to build up a private general practice. And I did a lot of things that would be unheard of today for general practitioners. For example, I delivered babies and took care of ear, nose, and throat problems and saw children. As a matter of fact, did a lot of pediatrics as well as the general medical care. We made house calls and a lot of things that people are not so much aware of.
Do you happen to remember the fee rates for house call and for office call?
Yes, my fee rate at that time was about $5 for a house call and $3 for an office call. It was about that time that the Jewish Home for the Aged decided to install a health department that Montefiore Hospital had served as the medical care facility for the Jewish Home for the Aged. It decided to have one on the premises, and therefore the top floor of the Jewish Home was designated as the hospital floor. And I volunteered to do the position of helping to run that organization, and I was accompanied in partnership with that endeavor by a physician by the name of Nate Alpern, who was a couple of years older than I, and as far as I know, still practices somewhat, mostly retired in Pittsburgh today. And we would take turns going out to the Jewish Home for the Aged. I would be there in the morning, we would be there in the afternoon. We would have a clinic or see patients in an office there. We had a nurse. We would prescribe, and those patients who were sick enough were transferred to Montefiore Hospital. And minimal care facilities were available, including x-rays. So that it was possible to take care of the patient on, the premises. I remember in those days that a patient who was 65 years of age was considered aged, and if they had a simple disease, like gallbladder disease, it was very difficult to find a surgeon at that time who was willing to operate on a patient who was already 65 years of age. Now, reflecting on that today, we do major brain operations and heart operations on people much older than that, and really don't consider age a major factor as we did in those days. So even though we're talking about only 47 years ago, it really is an age in medicine. But that's the age in which I started private practice. And it was during my years in private practice until 1950, that everything went along swimmingly, including the fact that I was married for the first time. And the Korean War then broke out. And that had a serious effect because as a physician, I was obligated to go into the military service. Even though I had served in the military service during World War II, I was not a physician at that time, and therefore it didn't count towards the 2 years required of physician service. This was a law that was passed by Congress as an emergency act requiring that all physicians, unless otherwise deferred for physical reasons, would be required to serve 2 years as a physician, notwithstanding how much other time had been served, even in combat. This was unfair. There were a lot of people, medical people, who complained and fought in Congress about it. But this went to the, this law was taking challenge to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld the right of Congress to pass this law, which all still, in retrospect, sounds rather bizarre to me. Segment of the population was so designated, and it was particularly unusual because the service did use a lot of specialized people and specialized trained engineers and so forth, but they were given civil service raises, and they were induced to go into service by the fact that they were paid substantial amounts of money to do so. But the medical profession was not considered in this category. It was then that I realized that the government was not the friend of the physician. And I think that still prevails, the feeling still prevails today among those doctors. Nonetheless, I did go into the service and learned a lot while I was in the service. Having been a general practitioner, stood me in good stead in knowing how to deal with patients on a one-to-one basis. But on the other hand, again, the military, and that is representing the government, did not have much respect for those who had simply served in general practice. And therefore, we were at the bottom of the totem pole, and our job was to take care of the outpatient clinics, which consisted mostly of people who we considered at that time to be gold-bricking. Gold-bricking was a term meant that they didn't want to work, or they didn't want to take their responsibilities or their duties, and they complained that they had a headache or a backache or some problem that was not easily diagnosable or easily discernible, and therefore they lined up, and particularly with this too on Monday morning after the fellows had been off for the weekend and had gone on leave or liberty, and came back after an all-night bus ride, they would then report Monday morning. So the experience, medical experience, was not great, but it did make me aware of some of the problems that people face on a day-to-day basis in just getting through life. I did find that enlightening. I also would point out that I was the only Jew in my outfit. I was stationed in South Carolina. I learned a lot about what it was like to be in the South in those days immediately following World War II. It was a new experience. I learned what it was to be in a non-Jewish hospital run essentially by people who were not Jewish. That was an experience worth going through. But particularly I remember when Christmas came, I volunteered to work on Christmas. I said, since I'm the only Jew here and it's not my holiday, I would be happy to take full duty for the entire Christmas holiday so that everybody could spend their time with their families, many of whom have families come from out of town to join them. It was interesting that they wouldn't hear of it. They absolutely insisted that I celebrate Christmas. They couldn't believe, even though I was then separated from my wife and had no children and had no reason, religious reason, to be celebrating, they couldn't accept that and would insist. And I learned something from that, that people who had not been exposed to Jews, they didn't understand the difference. They had total loss of that, the recognition that I should be any different from them. So nonetheless, that year had some interesting aspects to it. I was somewhat fortunate in that I was then assigned to go to what's called flight surgeon school. And that was in Randolph, Texas. What year was that? That was in, that would be 1951. I went to Randolph Air Base. And my first wife and I went there together. That turned out to be a very rewarding experience. The education was superb. I learned a great deal about ear, nose, and throat and eye examinations. And this stood me in good stead later in my neurosurgical career, neurological career. But certainly at that time, it was my idea to use some of this information just in the practice of medicine, because those kinds of specialties were not made available in the average educational medical school education experience. I therefore graduated. After that school was for 3 months, and then I was sent to Europe rather than Korea, which was somewhat of a break, and that turned out to be a splendid experience. I had been in Europe in 1948 after World War II as a representative of Young People of America, touring Europe for a joint so that I could report to the American youth on what was going on with the refugee situation and the establishment of Israel. I'd always vowed that I would return to Europe and had planned in my life that I would spend a lot of time there. Unfortunately, this came up in 1951, which was only 2 years later. I was very familiar. I had been all over Europe. I felt that I was a seasoned traveler. So it was a great experience to be transferred as a flight surgeon to a flight wing in Europe. The assignment was to a base called Chaumont, France, in which I was the deputy medical commander, and it was an air base. I don't even remember the name. We had an air wing, and we had the first jets that were flown in the United States Air Force. They were called the F-84s, I believe. And we had training planes in which I was permitted to fly as a passenger, a two-seater for training purposes, and that was the first jet that I ever entered. That was called the T-80, if I'm not correct. Mistaken. And at any rate, this experience on the base was essentially the experience of doing general practice of medicine. My exposure, however, to French medicine was rather shocking. I found that when I was naive about facts of medicine in general. I was very idealistic in those days about taking care of people and making good diagnoses and so forth. But what was interesting in France, our people from the base who had their families there. This was not in wartime. This was wartime only in the sense that it was during the Korean War, but there was no war in Europe, so families were permitted to go over there. They had to use French doctors because emergency medical care was not available to the families at that time, some of the American doctors. And I was always shocked to find out that it didn't matter what was the matter with a patient, the French doctors always made the same diagnosis, and the diagnosis was liver trouble. Everybody that I saw was told that they had liver trouble. So I realized that good general practice or good medicine was not being practiced worldwide, and certainly not in the provinces in France in those days. Off the top of my head, I can't recall any special experiences that occurred at that time. Oh yes, one, I became interested in the subject of low back pain, and because every pilot experienced low back pain, I realized at that time, and I don't know how I got into this, because I was certainly not a neurosurgeon, which is part of my specialty, I was certainly not a neurosurgeon at that time, but I knew a lot about backs, and I realized that one of the reasons that every pilot had backache was because the seat of the F-84 the configuration was such that when a pilot drew negative G-force, that the weight of the lower back had no support. And I made a special effort in monthly reports to try to get the Air Force change the configuration of the F-84, and I learned something else. I learned that nobody was interested in the pilot. But they were only interested in weight, in firepower, in range, in climbing speeds. Nobody was interested in the comfort or well-being of the pilot. which is somewhat again to me, a naive young fellow like myself, is rather shocking. It was during this period of time that I made many friends. I traveled a lot as a flight surgeon. It was necessary for me to check out pilots, so that it was the opportunity for me to take flights in other parts of Europe occurred almost on a daily basis. And we would, for instance, in those days, check out a couple pilots by taking a flight to Rome and have lunch and then come back. So it turned into quite a worldly experience and a very pleasurable experience and with wonderful people. And learned a lot of French and learned a lot about Europe. It also was unfortunate that this came at a time when I then became separated from my wife, we were in the process of divorce while I was over there. But nonetheless, that year came to an end, and I came back to Pittsburgh, but I learned one thing for sure, that the age of general practice of medicine had come to an end. So my career took a definite turn, and I planned, therefore, to specialize. While I had interned at Montefiore Hospital in Pittsburgh, I became friendly with the neurosurgeon, whose name was David Costa. I had assisted him at surgery as an intern quite frequently because we didn't have a neurosurgical residency program. At that time, there weren't very many residency programs. We did have general surgical programs, but they were busy learning general surgery, and therefore, since I liked Kostov so much as a personality, and took an interest in a lot of what he had to say, he was particularly interested in the mind as well as the brain, and I thought that was fascinating, and followed him around a lot. It was during this period of time that he had become rather famous by performing what was considered to be a unique operation called a lobotomy on a criminal. The criminal's name was Wilbur Wright. A book followed, but I happened to be in the middle of that experience with under Kostov's guidance, and Kostov therefore seemed like an attractive person for me to follow, and therefore when I came back I took up the field of neurosurgery under Kostov.
Just a quick word, what was the effect on Wilbur Wright, do you remember?
Oh yes, Wilbur Wright became a better criminal than he had before. He had no affect about, didn't worry about getting caught by the police. He enjoyed very much outsmarting the police. As a matter of fact, really was not a bad person. He didn't harm people. It was a matter of playing games and trying to play tricks. And Wilbur Wright, it was the most interesting part of that story, and I think it's fair to tell it because now that I've gotten started, was the fact that the strange things happen from the simplest people. I think Winston Churchill once said in one of his books something to that effect, that the average person can rise to the sublime in times of stress, in times of importance. And he was referring to the sinking of the French fleet by the British, the Vichy French fleet. And some French navy were killed, and yet when they buried their dead sailors, they still showed great respect for the British flag and did not in any way condemn the British for that. And Winston Churchill wrote a nice speech about that in the Gate of Parliament, how the common man sometimes rises above expectations and times of need. And this applies, or always thought of it as applying to the case of Wilbur Wright. Wilbur Wright was finally apprehended. and he was placed in jail in Butler. This was long after my internship, and at the time that I was now a resident at Montefiore Hospital in surgery, and particularly working in neurosurgery with David Pascoe. And David Pascoe had a country place at a resort called Bear Rocks. And it was bear, and it was rocky. Bear Rocks later became quite a project for some developers in Pittsburgh. Young man who was my son by the name of Tillman that took that over and made the development out of it. But at that time, the day the crust up was there, it was very primitive, very backward area. And we had no telephone, but we would go up there on weekends. And interestingly, we would frequently be accompanied by Peter Lindstrom. Peter Lindstrom was the husband, and also a neurosurgeon, was the husband of Ingrid Bergman. And Pia Lindstrom, the daughter, would go with us. She was then 15 and 16 years old. She was a gorgeous young woman. And I have many photographs of that experience, but that's off the track. In the meantime, we were there for a weekend, and we got a call. Very important, the message came, and the message came by automobile from the farmhouse down the road, since we didn't have a phone, saying that the state police had come there looking for Dr. Kostoff. Well, Dr. Kostoff was the kind of man that, he was a thinker and a man of great brilliance, and a man of great charm in many ways, but he knew how to delegate. And one of the things he didn't do was move or function in a physical way if he didn't have to. So that was my assignment. Late, go find out what the police want. It turned out that the police from Butler Barracks were trying to get a hold of Prescott, and the reason that they were was because Wilbur Wright had committed suicide, and they wanted to know if Dr. Kostoff wanted his brain. Now, this was, you have to realize how significant that is for the police. You always say they're not well-educated and this and that, but the sensitivity of a policeman in Butler, Pennsylvania, to be aware of the scientific value of having the brain at autopsy on such an instance, such a unique case, that it really made the case of Wilbur Wright from the point of view of scientific value of lobotomy as an acceptable procedure. It made it so important because, you know, people would say, no matter what you wrote about the case, well, how do you know you cut the right nerve fibers, and et cetera, et cetera. But it turned out that this was unusual. Now, how did Wilbur Wright commit suicide? He still tried to outsmart the police. So he hung himself in his head, over the head, the toilet. Right. And what he did was cut his wrist with a razor blade, then hung himself and flushed the razor blade down the toilet before he died. So that the police, seeing the blood from his wrist, had to find the murder weapon and had to solve the problem. So then the police had to dig up the latrine area to find the bullets. So that in a way, to the very last, Wilbur Wright, with this lobotomized brain, was able to outsmart the police. And we learned an awful lot about lobotomy. Lobotomy at that time was a very, very significant, important operation. As a matter of fact, the man won the medical Nobel Prize winner was Alameda Lima of Portugal, and he won the Nobel Prize for the operation called prefrontal lobotomy. So this is how important it was considered at that time. Now, this taught us many things. The fact that certainly it didn't affect the intellect and having a complete lobotomy, the story came that the brain was salvaged. The brain was sent to Harvard to a very famous neuropathologist who did the sections of the brain and proved that it was a perfect lobotomy as described, and therefore we were able to find out that it wasn't a fluke, that this was a lobotomy, and that the lobotomy didn't do what it was supposed to do, what everybody said it was going to do.
Didn't
yes.
President Kennedy's sister, the retarded sister, have a lobotomy?
I don't know that, maybe. But at any rate, that was a great experience, and this was during my stay at Montefiore Hospital. The other interesting thing about this was that it created such controversy. Lobotomy was considered to be tampering with the personality, and this whole business called psychosurgery became a very significant thing in the press and among protest groups about, are we allowed to tamper with the mind?